Welcome, everyone. I'm Jeffrey Goodman, Director of Marketing and Development for the YMCA of Northwest Louisiana. We're here at 318 Latino Studios for Shreveport-Bossier, my city, my community, my home. And I can't wait to have today's discussion. I know I'm going to learn a lot, and I know you will as well. Our guest today is Ross Barrett. Ross, thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Of course. All right, Ross. So we're going to get all into your world today, which is really fascinating, multifaceted. So you are, I'm just going to say you're a venture capitalist. You do so much, but you're a venture capitalist. So let's start here today. For the lay people out there, and I put myself in that group, could you explain what venture capital is and how you got into the space
Sure.
to begin with?
Absolutely. So just at the highest level, there's a difference between debt and equity. So a bank will loan you money, and that's in the form of debt quite often. And then on the other end of the spectrum is equity, and that takes all types of different flavors. It can be an angel investor. So, for example, you wanted to put up some capital to help start a restaurant, and in exchange, you get a 5 or 10 or 15 or 20% interest in that restaurant. What we do is we actually manage institutional money. So foundations, endowments, they'll go and won't do the typical 60-40 split, 60 stocks and 40 bonds. They may do 60% in equities and then 30% in bonds and 10% in alternative investments. And that's what venture capital is. It falls into the alternative investments. My job is very simple. It's to turn a penny into a nickel. So if somebody gives me capital, we invest it in companies. And after the partnership is dissolved, that $1 should be, you know, at least a nickel, $5, if that makes sense. That takes the shape of many different forms of equity where we invest. Broadly speaking, we invest globally. And then specifically, we invest only in cancer companies. So that's what I do right now with the Cancer Focus Fund. I'm also an entrepreneur in my own right. I'm chairman of a company called Lanyap Labs. And Lanyap Labs is a company that works with Wall Street firms to create an index that tracks the venture capital industry. It's something that I saw was needed in the industry, and so some colleagues and I got together and have created the first index that actually tracks the progress or the lack thereof of the United States venture capital industry. And there's lots of neat things that you can do around that. You can benchmark around that. You can create investable products around that. You can create secondary special purpose vehicles around that. And so a lot of my time is spent in New York and San Francisco and other areas of global finance.
So you and I have known you, I think, since probably Southfield days.
Yeah.
I was in fifth grade. You were maybe in seventh or eighth grade.
Yeah.
So how does one who comes from Shreveport, comes from Southfield, get into venture capital?
Yeah, Southfield. It was all due to Southfield. No, Southfield is a great school. You know, to some extent, you know, I was saying that in somewhat in jest, but at an early age, I was fed books, and which fed my curiosity, which, you know, this lifelong learning cycle. And so I've always been curious, and I've always read a lot. And so, you know, after got out of Southfield, went to Loyola, finished my college at SMU. I didn't have a job, didn't have any money. I took my car and my then girlfriend, now wife, up to Washington, D.C. and worked on Capitol Hill. And these, you know, these doors of opportunity just kind of open, and you have to, you know, seek wisdom out whether or not to go through it or not go through it. So my first boss was J. Bennett Johnston, okay? And I had a science degree from SMU, and so most everyone has, you know, history degrees or political science degrees, but I had a minor in biological sciences. And so anything to do with anything science, they threw on my desk to take a look at. And in fact, there was actually a pretty rigorous due diligence process. I didn't know what due diligence was then. They called it risk assessment. But that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. When I deploy capital into a company, we do the same due diligence, or very similar due diligence, that I did, you know, at 22, 23, 24 on Capitol Hill. And basically, you're looking at the quality of the people that are either asking for money in the terms of government or looking for a government contract. So we did some neat things. LSU had a joint venture, I believe, with Caltech and MIT. It was called LIGO, L-I-G-O, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Observatory, L-I-G-O. And 25 years ago, they said, you know, Ross or Senator Johnston, we are going to prove Einstein's theory of gravitational waves, but it's going to take us 30 years to do it. About 5 years ago, I saw an article in Scientific America, and they proved it. That was something that the federal government funded. And to track gravitational waves. And so those were the types of things that really just drew me in, and I loved that. And so, you know, from there, when Senator Johnston decided not to run for reelection, I went to law school at LSU, and then after that, finished at NYU, where I got a master's. And
in
that,
taxation law,
yes,
right?
Mm-hmm. And they let you really design your course load to what you like. And they were very flexible in letting me take classes at the Stern School of Business as well as NYU Law. And so one of the classes I took was Fundamentals of Venture Capital. And that was in the late 90s. And an adjunct professor, the guy who taught the class, ended up being a mentor of mine, helped get me into the business. So after graduation, I actually never practiced law. I actually went to go work for a broker-dealer that does private placements. And at that point, I got to continue to do due diligence on these investment opportunities.
And where was that? Was that in New York?
That was in New York, yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we were right off of Times Square on 46th Street. Just a great little location. And I was the young person there, and I got to really learn from some titans of industry, and just cut my teeth again as kind of the young grunt. And but we called on venture capital firms. And so I got to ask the same question of them that you just asked me: how'd you get in this business? And so, you know, there's no one pathway. You know, if you want to be a lawyer, there's a pathway, or a dentist, there's a pathway. To get into the venture capital world, it's almost by happenstance. Oftentimes, it's an operator of a business, an entrepreneur yourself. So that is a common characteristic, because an entrepreneur has to go out, unless they come from money, they have to go out and raise capital. And typically that comes from family and friends first. Some people call it family, friends, and fools. You know, you got to be careful with that. But, you know, you're raising capital from family and friends, and then there's perhaps a government program out there where you can leverage non-dilutive capital or institutional capital like the venture capitalist. And, you know, that's really one of the competitive edges of the United States, is that we have a very vibrant venture capital industry that invest widely in everything from social media to cancer therapeutics, advanced manufacturing, and everything under the sun. Most of the folks were on the East Coast and in San Francisco, and that's changing, and it certainly has changed since COVID and Zoom. So was in New York for about 5 years, and got recruited back to the state by then Governor Foster to help pull together a venture capital platform investment fund. And from there, got to know some of the family offices here in Louisiana.
When you came back to Louisiana,
yes.
Did you go to Baton Rouge? Were you living and working in Baton Rouge?
No, I was.
Or you came back to Shreveport?
No, we came back to Shreveport. So my wife Allison is from here. Her parents had Centenary Hardware, if you remember that, over by Strawn's. And so we had deep roots here. And, you know, Shreveport and Bossier, great place to raise your kids. We had two kids at that point. And the grandparents in place. And so, you know, we really felt called to come back here. And I knew that I was going to have to travel a lot, which has gotten progressively smaller and smaller, especially because of Zoom and, you know, before that conference calls. But
let me interrupt one sec. So when you got back here, because I came back in 2005, you were already back, you were established in Bossier, where
yep.
I think you are, you still have one of your offices
yep.
today. At the time, you were really the only guy I would call a venture capitalist locally. When you arrived back here in the late 90s or early 2000s, were you the first quote-unquote venture capitalist ever in Shreveport-Bossier? That's the first part of the question. The second
yeah.
part of the question is, how much did you have to educate people locally on what that even means?
Right. Now, so let me answer them in the opposite order. So there was a lot of education until you meet certain people. And Mr. Franks, John Franks, got it right away. My dear friend and business partner, John Turner, said, Ross, I've been doing that all my life. Why don't you come and office with me? And so there were so many people that I did have to educate. This is how we operate, and this is how we get paid. This is where the interests align, because we have a thing called a carried interest, and basically that aligns my success with the fund's success and the fund's success with my success. And so there was a lot of that. But, you know, the great thing about our community is that there are a lot of entrepreneurial people here. There's a lot of concentrated wealth here. And, you know, I remember Mr. Franks telling me, who wasn't in business with me, but he said, you know, I'd rather take, you know, 10% of 10 wells and 100% in one well. And I was like, well, that's kind of what we do, but just not in the energy industry. So, but to your point, when we met in Bossier, I was in business with John Turner and Bill Windham, and still in business with Bill today. Mr. Turner passed away, but really, you know, involvement with him directed my life in a pathway that that was really significant. So,
and would you say, were you the first "quote unquote" venture capitalist in Shreveport-Bossier?
Well, since Mr. Turner said that he'd been doing it all of his life, I would say no.
But aside from him, maybe.
Yeah. There have been different flavors and stripes of it, but with respect to what we were doing, there was actually, and this was a policy I think that Kathleen Blanco had put in motion. The goal was to attract people like myself that had this, you know, kind of rare skill set, not rare, but just not common skill set, to actually come live here back in Louisiana. So at the same time I moved back in the mid-2000s, there was an effort in Baton Rouge with LSU to put together a similar fund, and they recruited a guy named Joe Lovett, who had worked with the Harvard investment funds in the past. And so we were here at the same time, and the industry's, you know, big industry, small business, the industry is small enough that where we collaborate. So we invested together a lot. And it was a lot easier since he was established as well. And then subsequent to that, there's been, you know, an amazing growth of angel funds. And there's one here that the BRF supports through Dr. John George and his efforts with Dave Smith and Julie Gilley. And that's called the North Louisiana Angel Funds. And so that popped up, and that's what I would call kind of institutionalized. They do great due diligence and review things in a real professional manner. There's a group down in Baton Rouge that's kind of similar. There's one in New Orleans, the New Orleans Angel Group. There's East Texas, Austin, Dallas, and Houston.
And what's the distinction or differentiation between an angel fund mm-hmm. and just a generic venture capital fund?
It's a great question. So, and I'll even take it one step back to just first principles on angel investing. So an angel, quote unquote, is somebody who swoops in like an angel and helps the entrepreneur. You know, entrepreneur is about, you know, to run out of payroll money or needs that last co-signatory to get a loan to do, you know, a CapEx project. It's very unregulated. Angel investing is very unregulated and fragmented. You're going to have it all over, you know, all over the world, quite frankly, but the concept is the same. In exchange for my money, I get a share of your future profits. So that's how Columbus financed his voyage. He got it from the Queen, and she said, okay, in exchange for my money to underwrite this, I want X percentage of your profits of whatever you get. And so that concept has been around for quite some time. And that is what an angel investor does, as well as a venture capital fund. So an angel investor is just one person to one entrepreneur. They may do it once, they may do it 20 times. An angel fund is slightly different. So an angel fund seeks those angel investors, seeks people that will write them a check. And then you pool your money from, let's just say, you know, 50 people put up $10,000 a piece, and that's $500,000. And then you have a fund manager or director of operations that kind of quarterbacks the process. And that angel fund then goes and seeks investments that may be a little bit further along, or because they have more money, they can take a higher investment into the company than just one individual. So it's kind of strength through numbers.
Fund may seek numerous investments for that fund, right? Seeking one.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a distinction. Whereas just an angel investor may make one a year, the angel fund may seek, you know, one a quarter. But they can do that because they've aggregated all of this money. And so, you know, back in the late 90s, I remember the New York Angels when we were living in Manhattan, and there's a guy named Alan Patrickoff, and he's a big media person, and he would come and he would write $50,000 checks after the people would do their pitch, if that makes sense. So that's a perfect example of an angel investor. An angel fund, you know, he would write it to a fund, and it's called typically over a 3 or 4 year period. The capital is called, and then the capital is put to work, you know, on a case by case basis after the due diligence is done, after the market analysis. You know, I give the example of Microsoft. If Microsoft was the software world was a $10 million a year business, Bill Gates would have a great $9 million a year company, right? But through innovation and just the growth of the computing power and all of that, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar, if not trillion dollar business. And so that's what we also look at, both angel investors as well as venture capitalists, is, you know, how big is the market? And determining how big that market is absolutely critical, because, you know, $10,000 invested in Microsoft before it went public would be worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars. $10,000 in your local retail store, for example, just the market's not that big. And so the risk reward is different.
Okay. And then like a venture capital fund versus angel fund, did we make that distinction?
No, we didn't. Okay. We didn't. Thank you for reminding me. So a venture capital fund is managed by, well, first of all, it's typically a 10-year limited partnership. And that's a legal concept that it has a beginning and it has an end. And the first 5 years is when that capital is invested. And then the rest is the harvest period. And so there are, you know, legal and regulatory SEC requirements that if you're raising certain amounts of money from certain types of people, then you have to, you know, be regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, follow certain rules. There's a thing called the blue sky laws that you have to comport with or comply with.
These are accredited, unaccredited.
Correct.
One such category.
That's correct. And that was done really because in the 18, and this is why we were talking earlier about how human nature doesn't change. In the late 1800s, when the railroads were coming around, it was very fragmented. And you would have like the Shreveport to Tyler Railroad. Where did they get their money? Oftentimes you would have scoundrels go out to like widows and orphans and say, put, you know, $500 with me and, you know, I'll promise you the blue sky. And that's the term blue sky laws. And so you cannot solicit certain investors without knowing their investment profile, their sophistication, and those types of things. So one key distinction between venture capital funds is that they go to qualified institutional buyers. That's a term of art, QIBs. QIBs could be like a family office. QIBs could be an endowment. It could be like the LSU Health Science Center Foundation. And they have capital. People give them money. And they don't just keep that in a bank. You know, they invest it into things. And that's why, you know, you go back to the 60-40, you may not want 60% in stocks and 40% in alternatives. You wouldn't want that, but you do want a sliver in alternatives. That's kind of considered best practice. And so,
And pension funds are QIBs?
Funds are QIBs. So like Louisiana Teachers, was reading last night, $26 billion of capital. They haven't invested in stocks, bonds, alternatives, real estate, you know, energy funds, you know, just to diversify because there's a lot of retired teachers and you've got to pay those pensions out. But you think about how many pension funds there are in the United States and you start to see, you know, their need to get yield or chase what they call alpha. And that means they're looking for slightly riskier bets for a significantly different return profile. So in some cases, you know, the job I said earlier was turning a penny into a nickel. That's just kind of a colloquial way of describing it. Sometimes you want to turn that, you know, a 10Xer or, you know, some of the people that invested in Uber early on got 400 times their money back. So you can imagine putting just $10,000, but what if you put $100,000 into it, you know? And so those types of big winners, you know, the Googles, the Ubers, the Microsofts of the world, some of the stuff that Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX is, you know, where you could put a little bit of capital at risk for a huge reward. And that, to cycle it back to what Lanyap Labs and the Prime Unicorn Index does, that's what we do, is we track the value of that, but then create investable products around that. So people can get in pre-IPO and really see those outsized returns.
And do we answer? So we made the big distinction between venture capital and angel is maybe this 10-year structure. And focus more on the QIBs.
Yes. Yeah, I would say it's the type of investor profile,
okay,
which is the primary difference. And then, of course, you do have that 10-year limited partnership model. You also have a formalized GP for general partner, and I act as general partner for the investment funds that I manage. And so, and that's where you have the alignment of interest is, you know, the GP typically gets 20% of the profits. And so it's like Charlie Munger said, show me the incentives and I'll show you the result. You know, I'm highly motivated to make sure that I work extra hard and make sure that we do the due diligence and the market analysis, because you only have so many bets to do. And we want to make sure that we're you know, de-risking an inherently more risky asset class as much as we possibly can. So I would say that's the difference between the angels, which is typically just an individual writing you a check, versus kind of a venture capital fund. Like, they're professionally managed, professionally run, best case. I mean, there's best use cases, things along those lines.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to shift you. So as we started talking about, you're involved in multiple companies. And I want to give people a sense of your work and world by focusing on a few of them. You've already talked a little bit about Lanyap Labs. So let's shift to another company where you're deeply involved. Tell me, if you could, about Esperance mm-hmm. Pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, so a great example, and it can also lead to where I am today and how I got partnered up with Ochsner, LSU, and MD Anderson. So the Pennington Biomedical Research Center is part of LSU. It's in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The Pennington is actually...
And this isn't... Let me just interrupt one sec. This isn't terribly different than our BRF or our Biomed, or it's very different?
I would say it's very different.
Okay.
Because the BRF is encompassing and the Pennington with a lot of different programs, from high school education to running the Center for Molecular Imaging, to having real estate on LSU's Health Sciences Center campus. The Pennington Biomedical Research Center is a research center, and they do research primarily into chronic diseases and obesity. So there was a researcher, a guy named Dr. Bill Hansel, that worked at the Pennington. And he was actually 75 years old. The reason why I know that he was 75 when he moved there is because Cornell University, in their infinite wisdom, forced him to retire. And at 75, he moved to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to continue his research into chronic diseases via lytic peptides. Lytic peptides are amino acids that have a wide variety of use in the body. He had a concept that if you tie a lytic peptide to a hormone, that hormone would go to a hormone receptor. So almost think of it as there's a lock and you have a key. And so that key will only go to that one lock. And so in his mind, he said, well, if you put a little bomb on that key and you go and you turn it, it'll blow it up. That's what he did with cancer. He found a hormone receptor that was overexpressed on certain types of cancers, and through lytic peptides got a delivery payload there. So I think another example would be like a smart bomb that's by GPS. Okay. So he had this concept, but it was just a concept. And he also had a patent that LSU owned that wasn't great. It was good, but not great. Didn't have worldwide capabilities. It just had the U.S. And so my investment fund at that point syndicated, or we got two other groups that were professionally managed, Louisiana Fund, Joe Lovett and Rick Babb out of Baton Rouge, and then a group called RCT, Research Corporation Technologies, out of Tucson, Arizona, of all places. And so we three came together And we put up the first $1 million in aggregate. So we each put up $333,000 to license the technology from LSU, to take that to a patent lawyer, get better patents, and do what's called pre-tox work. So studies on mice and rats and stuff like that.
Toxicology. Okay.
And so with the first $1 million, and again, we gave the company money, and in exchange, we got an equity share in the company. We licensed the technology from LSU, and that's a process in and of itself that you have to go through, involving lawyers and patent lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have to decide whether or not to put more money in. Once you get the license, you own the intellectual property, you find that you can have patent coverage worldwide, and you think the darn thing's going to work. And so so we were fortunate then to do a what
and
we
let me pause you one sec. So at this point, what is the ultimate goal? Like, what are we hoping this
so
technology is going to
do? So we're hoping, and we're still hoping today, which is I'll circle back on that point on how long these projects can take. But the ultimate goal is to sell the company to a big pharmaceutical company like Merck or Bristol-Myers Squibb. The way that the industry works is that the small biotechs are the quick, nimble, innovative ones. And big pharma are willing to pay big dollars for innovative, next-generation type technologies. They figure, let the market do it itself. And so you have, you know, individuals like me that put capital in, and we're hoping again for a big outsize type return.
And you're going through a proof of concept basically, is that correct? Or I'm sure there's more formal lingo there, but.
Yeah, so you do what's called preclinical studies for an IND, initial new drug, a filing with the United States Food and Drug Administration, because they're not going to let just any drug, you know, go to market. Could hurt you, could have some random side effect. At any rate, the process that we went through included all of the preclinical studies, and then we were able to syndicate an investment round of close to $9 million to take it through what's called phase one. And phase one is just to make sure that the drug is safe and it won't kill you, you know, because there are drugs that you can take and they have, you know, what's called an adverse event and you pull it from the market. That actually stems, for the history buffs in here, from the thalidomide cases in the 1960s. Thalidomide was a nausea medicine that was given to pregnant women, but it caused children to have club feet and club hands, and they call them the thalidomide babies. Once that happened, the FDA stopped in and said, no, we're going to regulate this industry. And so it's very expensive, but quite frankly, it's needed. You know, regulation is not always a bad word. And in this case, it's really needed. And it's very clear what steps you have to take to get that drug to market. And in fact, the US FDA is kind of the leader in the world. Everyone looks to our policies. So we should be proud of that. So we did the phase one study. And then we did a phase two study that was actually an investment round, because we spent the $1 million, we spent the $9 million, and then we got an outside drug company to come in to lead the next investment round, and that's to show efficacy, not only that the drug is active and non-toxic, but it actually works. And so that's driven by a fancy statistics word called p-value. And unfortunately, the company didn't hit its intended endpoints. But in a subset of patients that had liver cancer, it did hit that endpoint. And so on the strength of that data, we were able to out-license it to a new company, and that new company is still working through the FDA process. So we're hopeful that that drug will ultimately get to market, but we're still working on it. But that's almost a decade plus time, and so it requires patience, but it also requires action today. It's like the old story my friend Phil Roseman says, you know, what's the best time to plant a tree? You know, 25 years ago. What's the second best time? Today. So you have to be, you know, continually active in doing these projects, because quite often they'll take longer and take more capital than you expect.
And when you out-license it, like you said, to this other company, we're not at the big pharma stage yet. So this other company is what is the difference between them, this new company, and
right.
who you were with the initial syndicate?
That one was just simple access to capital. They had access to capital, and it takes management and capital. And so that's the biggest difference.
Okay. All right. So we're going to shift you to another company
okay.
that you're very involved in. And that's the Cancer Focus Fund, which I think is a large amount of your effort, mm-hmm. attention, and work today. So tell us about Cancer
yeah.
Focus Fund.
Yeah, and so that's a great segue, because with the company Esperanza, it was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Remember, it was a cancer company. The what you call the principal investigator or the lead doctor was at MD Anderson, Dr. Rob Coleman. And Dr. Anil Sood, they were at MD Anderson, although you have these different sites. In fact, there was a site in Shreveport for the Esperance drug as well. And so typically they're distributed all over the U.S. because you're looking for patients to give your experimental drugs to. So that company, those doctors were at MD Anderson, and I got introduced to my friend Ferran Pratt at MD Anderson, who's head of what's called Strategic Industry Ventures, SIV. And that's the outward-facing group for MD Anderson, which is an academic cancer center, academic research center, to biotech and big pharma. So they had to have somebody with, you know, a business mind to be able to, you know, work with industry partners.
And MD Anderson mainly in Houston, or where are we
headed? Yeah, in Houston.
Okay.
Yep, that's correct. And so this gentleman, my friend and colleague Ferran, had a vision that it would be great if the companies that run the clinical trials at these cancer centers or at these hospitals, instead of just paying them cost plus to run the trial, well, what if he's thinking like a venture capitalist? What if we had a royalty? So there's a drug called Keytruda. It's an immuno-oncology drug. It's becoming standard of care for melanoma and other types of lung cancers. It harnesses your body's immune system to kill the cancer versus chemotherapeutics or lytic peptides, which actually go kill the cancer itself. Chemo, 100 years from now, is going to be like bloodletting, you know, how they used to do, and that's how George Washington died. It just doesn't make sense to kill your entire system, right? And in doing so, almost killing yourself. Although it's been effective, the side effects are horrific. And there's a real revolution right now in what's called immuno-oncology, led by Dr. Jim Allison and this company, or this drug called Yervoy and Keytruda. Well, they do close to a combined sales of $20 billion a year. Okay, so what if you had 1% of those sales? You know, it would be a lot of wealth creation. And so MD Anderson wanted to create an investment vehicle like that, fraught with potential conflicts of interest. And so he needed an outside general partner to run that. And since I had experience for, you know, a decade and a half of doing that, and I had experience working with MD Anderson through Esperance, And the fact that we, just saw the world the same way, he said, Ross, go get them. And what I was able to do was bring our partners, Ochsner Health. They have a precision cancer center in New Orleans, which is now formally affiliated with MD Anderson. It's called the Ochsner Health MD Anderson Cancer Center, the ones in New Orleans, as well as LSU Feistweiler. And so we brought those strategic partners and capital from those partners, in addition to Rice Endowment. And the neat thing about
Rice
this
University.
Rice University in Houston.
Okay.
And the neat thing about this partnership is that we open up the clinical study for Company A at MD Anderson in Houston. Well, not everyone can afford to, take 6 months off of work and, go to MD Anderson. The neat thing is that we can, what's called cohort expand to New Orleans or Shreveport. And so we're looking for the cutting edge, best immuno-oncology, cell therapy companies from around the world. We're agnostic to where the technology comes from. It can come from Baton Rouge. It can come from Israel, and anywhere in between. But then we work with the company to set up a clinical study at MD Anderson. And then, with my Louisiana hat on, I'm proud of this. We can then expand that study to New Orleans and Shreveport. And so to me, as a native Louisianan, that's exciting. And that's something that not a lot of places in the world can, talk about. But we cohort expanded the first one to New Orleans last year. It's a company called Nectin Therapeutics. They're actually out of Israel. They're treating solid tumors, and they've got approximately 40 patients, 25 or so from Houston and 15 or so from New Orleans region. And so that's what we're hoping to do and replicate over and over and over again with our next fund and our next fund after that.
And with these trials, the end goal or the hope is that we come up with a new drug or a new procedure that, or I guess a new drug.
Yep, that's exactly right.
That is available to big pharma.
Yep,
to,
that's it. I mean, you've nailed it in a nutshell. It's the idea is that, the drug works. And what people may not appreciate about cancer is that you've got a prostate and I've got a prostate, but our prostate cancer is not the same. You may have some genetic variability that I don't have. And so what they do now is they look at these genetic biomarkers, and they are just the cancer treatment today is just radically different than it was 25 years ago. And so, they see Jeffrey's, genetic biomarker and versus Ross's, and, oh, well, you're going to get this treatment versus Ross, you're going to get this treatment. Compare that to 25 years ago, and we would just have gotten chemotherapy. So it's exciting time to be in this industry, and you can, do well and do good at the same time. So so that's how the Cancer Focus Fund got started. And bringing in these strategic partners from Louisiana, given the proximity, the fact that so many people train at MD Anderson and then come back, just plus the sophistication at Ochsner and at LSU, pulled together, this unique group of strategic partners to really make drug development and cancer therapeutics much more efficient.
And this may be an unfair question, but I know we were talking off camera before this started just about identity issues, self-esteem issues that we have locally. So, give me a sense of, this kind of work you're describing. I mean, is this happening in 1,000 cities across America? Is this happening in 10 places across America? Like, I get a sense listening to you that everything you're saying, these are things that we should be really proud to know are occurring here right in our backyard.
Yeah, no, thanks for asking that question. It hits on a lot of different levels. We should be proud of it because there are very few places in the world that this is happening. And it's happening down there on Kings Highway. And it's happening in New Orleans, and it's a collaboration with the largest cancer center in the world. But it didn't happen overnight. And so I acknowledge and I'm appreciative that we're standing on the shoulders of the people that came before us, whether it be a Bennett Johnston type or a Dr. McDonald, or anybody, Dr. Muslow, that were instrumental in getting the med schools started. Dr. Glass was one of the first leaders of Feistweiler Cancer Center, for example, but also people in the past, like Mr. Zadek, who was very supportive of Feistweiler, or Bubba Raspberry, who was most recently supportive of the LSU Health Sciences Center. We should be proud of what we have. It's very, very unique. And, you know, I think quite often, you know, what would another mid-sized city do if they could have an academic medical school in their backyard? You know, they would be shouting for joy. And, you know, if you put that up for bid, people would do whatever they could do to attract it there. And so we are and should be more and more supportive of the infrastructure and the things that we have, and also work together. John George does a great job with his efforts at the BRF, in particular with, you know, the Center for Molecular Imaging. I mean, Ray's Bio just got sold for $4 billion for a radiotherapeutic, and the facility down on the corner of Kings Highway and Mansfield Road could do that type of work. And so it's really, really neat. And that comes back from the early stages of the PET scan imaging and the cyclotron that Senator Johnston helped to secure funding for. And so so it's neat to see kind of all things put together. That was one of the projects I worked for my first job.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So let me get to my last formal question with you, and I will come back after that and see if there are other things you want to hit. And you talked a little bit about this, but my question is simply, you know, talk to me some about why someone like you with a global reach like you described would want to continue to remain in and call Shreveport home.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I appreciate it. I think it's a fantastic place. I think for the size of our city, there are so many more benefits versus detriments. And I'm a big believer you have to bloom where you're planted. And you can bellyache and say, oh, I want to move to Dallas, or I want to move over here to, you know, better place, and ignore the problems. What good does that do, you know? Shreveport has great facilities, whether it be, you know, historical things such as, you know, the Shreveport Symphony or the Opera, or Norton's Art Gallery, for example. Education-wise, LSUS is fantastic. Centenary College, I sit on the board at Centenary. I mean, they're doing some fantastic things at Centenary, attracting people in from outside here. You've got Barksdale Air Force Base and Global Strike, and just the military that decide to retire here. And so you have this really unique set of industries, not to mention the energy industry, which, you know, still we're an energy region, no doubt about it. And so so economically diverse, we've got facilities. I didn't even mention the port of Shreveport-Bossier or Caddo-Bossier. And so we have things that, appeal to kind of raising your kids or, you know, your social outings and things like that. I mean, we were talking about the Red River Revel before. I mean, that's the neatest thing around, right? I mean, who doesn't love going down and getting a corn dog at the Red River Revel? But think about, you know, everything from sports, like to the mud bugs that we have. And, people can always say, well, Dallas has this and Dallas have that. I mean, I don't think that's a proper apples to apples comparison. But then ultimately it comes down to the people, and the people are just, they're good-hearted, hardworking people. Now, do we have our problems? Absolutely. There's still racial divides that need to be addressed. There are socioeconomic divides that need to be addressed. Has been a history of, you know, ineffective government, and I'm glad that's in the past. I'm actually more bullish about our community now than I've ever been since I moved back. So,
I love that. Well, Ross, is there anything else we didn't hit? I have utmost respect for you. You've been a mentor for me through the years and been there whenever I needed you. So I applaud you for all your efforts. This community is super fortunate to have you. And you've just worked tirelessly since I've been back here for the last 20 years.
Well, the only thing I'll say is that use the word mentor and being open. There are so many people that were willing to help me. And I won't name, you know, individual investors and things like that. That wouldn't be appropriate. But some of the family offices here are as sophisticated as anywhere in the world. And just they care. They want our community to be better. And so therefore, they tend to help people that are trying to reinvest back into the community. And so for that, I'm very thankful. I'm not sure that any of what I just described would be available without leaders in the business community. I mean, we were talking about John Beard earlier. I mean, he's done phenomenal things with economic development, race relations, the Crawfords, the Atkins. As I mentioned, Bill Windham, John Turner, I'm sure I'm leaving people out. But there are just so many good people that really want for the betterment of our community. That's what I would say separates, you know, Shreveport-Bossier from other places. And again, I don't think that, you know, any of my initiatives would have been successful if you didn't have that type of mindset. So
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, that's it. I appreciate your time, but I will say this. I will say one last thing. You had talked about identity. I believe strongly that you have what you say. And so things like this, this podcast that you're doing, it's really a public service. And, it highlights what other people might not know. I mean, I'm a generally pretty private person. I don't get out there on social media or anything like that. But I think that venues and platforms like this are really important to get people to say, you know what, this is a great city. It's a great place to call home. And as long as the jobs are there, the people will come. And we just need to make sure the people will come. And the best way to do that is to speak positive things and not negative things about our community. And so I applaud you and what your efforts have been to, you know, look at things in a positive light.
Well, thanks, Ross.
You bet.
Really appreciate you being here and look forward to many, many, many more great things in years ahead for you.
You got it. Thanks, man.
Thank you.